Hello, everyone. This is Brian Murphy, Director of the Association of Clinical Documentation Improvement Specialists. I want to welcome you all to our fourth and final ACTIS quarterly conference call of 2012. I hope you had a great week this week, and you'll have some time off for Thanksgiving next week. I'm joined on today's call by Cheryl Erickson, Fran Jurak, Donna Wilson, Dee Bannett. Congratulations, Dee, who just was married and is no longer Dee Shad.
Thank you. Brian.
Lena Wilson, Dr. Trela Charite, and Dr. Robert Gold. We may be having some other advisory board members dialing in as the call goes on. So this is a quarterly conference call for our new members. These are kind of informal calls we have on a quarterly basis with our membership. We do get quite a number of pre-submitted questions that we go over, which comprises the bulk of the call. But they also gives you the opportunity to dial in and ask your questions live of the advisory board. It's a very simple process. You just press *1 on your telephone keypad. That will alert our operator on today's call that you have a question. If you have a technical problem, I'm told that you should press *0. That will alert our operator again that you have an issue, and they can fix that. But again, *1 to dial in at any time. I'll issue that reminder throughout the call. I'm going to just fill you in on a couple association-related issues before we get started with our questions. First of all, we're in the final stages of selecting speakers for our annual conference next May. We've got a number of great applications. Our conference committee is working very diligently on that, we're expanding to 2.5 days next year. We've got some great presentations in, and again, we should be, for those that have applied officially, you'll be knowing very, very shortly about that. Secondly, as you probably know, we have our advisory board members who are on serve a 3-year term of service with us, and we have, so at the end of this year, 4 of our board members will be up in terms of what they have provided to us as advisory board members. I just want to take a second to recognize the contributions of Jim Kennedy, Glenn Krause, Gail Marini, and Lena Wilson for the 3 years of terrific service to ACTIS and really the whole entire CDI profession over these last 3 years. They're not going anywhere, of course. They're just no longer serving on the advisory board. And I want to thank them. 2 of them are, Lena's on today's call. Dr. Kennedy may be dialing in a little bit later, but as you all know, they've been really great with their time and effort helping us, helping make ACTIS a better association, Glenn and Gail as well. So if you, it would be nice to maybe send them an email afterwards. Their email addresses can be found on our advisory board page. And finally, as a reminder, we've sent out this notice a couple times, but our application period for the advisory board closes on Monday. So please get those in. We have received some applications from our members, but if you haven't applied yet, please give it some thought. Our advisory board members are important positions. They certainly help me out. They provide industry leadership, comment to CMS, be on these quarterly calls, you know, weigh in on industry guidance, and really help to steer the direction of our association. So if you have not applied or you're thinking about it, if you go to our ACTIS Advisory Board page, we spell out clearly what it entails to be a board member and what qualifications we're looking for. One other thing I'm going to go over, we are now offering a CEU towards our CCDS certification for listening to these calls. I'll be giving out some directions at the midpoint of this call, but we are going to be offering a CEU. We've had a number of requests for that. And because we do cover a lot of regulations, technical information, coding, clinical information, you know, we're able to give this a CEU for these calls. So I'll be repeating those, how to get that CEU about mid-call. Finally, I did want to extend our sincere condolences to the family and friends of Sandy Nicholson. Sandy was a senior coding consultant with Dr. Gold's firm, DCBA. She was unfortunately killed in an automobile accident yesterday, Tuesday morning. And our thoughts and prayers do go out to her family, to Dr. Gold, who's on today's call, and to everyone at DCBA. You know, Sandy has done a lot of work with my parent company, HC Pro, speaker on a number of our programs, a writer for us, and we'll miss her, and I hope her family and friends are doing as best as they can. So with that, I'm going to, you know, again, we did receive a number of pre-submitted questions, probably 9 or 10 of them, that we're going to work through. And I do encourage folks that are listening to follow up. You know, they can press *1 if they have a follow-on question. I'll also just pause and allow people to comment, you know, on questions that aren't necessarily on our agenda. But this first question reads, I have a question regarding acknowledgement of pathology reports by the attending of record. We meet with a lot of resistance in this area. How are other CDI departments handling this issue? So I'll open that up to maybe to the advisory board to see if you guys have this issue, you know, and sort of how you might, you know, broach the issue with your physicians and how to get them to sort of acknowledge these path reports. You know, I'm sure I know a lot of query opportunities come out of that, and how you get the attending to acknowledge what's in there.
Brian, this is Dee. I can address that. I believe that, you know, it's our job to get the greatest specificity into the documentation, and so I see that the same as all of our other query opportunities where we're trying to get the complete picture of the patient in the medical record. So that's the way that I approach it with the physicians.
As a physician, I can tell you that a lot of the problem is that docs, you know, you're talking about board-certified colleagues in pathology. Why would I have to restate what a board-certified pathologist has already said? Mm-hmm. But once you point it out to them that these are the rules and this is the way we have to have it and we can't change the rules, then they seem to be more willing to comply.
Okay.
From Dr. Gold, another possible approach would be, and especially going to be to the surgeon who may be seeing the patient just for the biopsy or just for the procedure where the final path report comes back even after the patient's been discharged from the hospital. In the fact that the surgeon is the physician of record for the tumor board, that the information that's being submitted to the tumor board by the physician, the surgeon of record, it's associated with him, and if he would be kind enough to validate that what this finding was by the pathologist is really a reflection of what he found when he did the operation.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great advice. Any other commentary on that?
And this is Donna. I've actually worked in a cancer registry before, and when you don't have that information up front and actually from the attending verifying that, then like Dr. Gold said, the tumor registry statistics are out of whack. So it's very important. It's a big trickle-down theory for that.
There's one other aspect, and this is something that's come out relatively recently, that if indeed a TNM classification has been assigned to the patient's case, if we're talking about the presence or absence of lymph nodes or distant metastatic disease, that if the TNM, tumor nodes, metastases, classification has been validated by any physician, you can code from that and you don't have to get further clarification from the surgeon.
All right. Well, there's no other. That's all great stuff. I'm going to move on to our next pre-submitted question. Again, we do solicit these when we send out our notices about the quarterly calls. So these are all actual member questions. This next one is regarding the electronic medical record. We're starting to see really a lot more of these, and it's really interesting how the EHR is impacting CDI. And I'll just read this. Our director has suggested that we create electronic generated templates for our top 20 diagnoses in ICD-10. Templates will be available for the provider to choose to document on the electronic medical record. Template will be geared to capture the documentation need for accurate code assignment. Our director suggested that we send an electronic query that suggests the care provider use the template for the diagnosis, for example, CHF. However, I have mixed feelings on this, if it would be considered leading the physician to a diagnosis. Nurses and ward clerks have for many years put on paper records, clinical pathways for doctors, so maybe this would be considered the same. Then on the opposite side, I feel I may be suggesting a diagnosis that's not present on the chart by suggesting they use a certain template. Do you have any thoughts in regard to this matter?
Yeah, you talk to the doctor. Period.
Yeah. Is that your best practice, doctor?
That's the best way to do it.
If
you've worked with the doctors, whether you're talking about the docs in the emergency room to be able to identify that pulmonary edema as heart failure, or if you've worked with a cardiologist to be able to identify this ischemic cardiomyopathy with EF under 30% is indeed heart failure, and the same with the interventional doctors who are putting in defibrillators to say this is non-ischemic cardiomyopathy, New York Heart Association class 2 to 3, he's got to identify it as heart failure someplace. Then you can ask him any specificity you want, whether it's right, left, and if it's left, systolic, diastolic, acute, and chronic.
Okay. Any other thoughts on that? I'll just mention to our membership they'd like to weigh in on this if you're dealing with that issue and you've had any success stories to share. It's a pretty simple matter of pressing *1 on your telephone keypad, and we'd be glad to take your call. Just hearing a lot about this anecdotally from our members with these types of questions about the electronic record, what it's allowing to do and how it's kind of impacting their jobs and you know, what something that needs to be modified within the electronic record or whether it's okay to do. So I imagine these issues are going to continue to come up as we go along.
This is Cheryl. I just wanted to add that I would hope that having a template or something like this would not preclude education and speaking with the physicians and providing education regarding these diagnoses, because I think physicians still need to know why these questions are being asked and what are the potential responses that they might have to make sure that this is an appropriate type of response in the template and that they aren't being forced to a particular response without having full knowledge of the implications of that response. So while it may seem like a time saver, the other thing, in my opinion, is if we're looking at the top 20 diagnoses as this person suggested, then those are already being documented. So perhaps what you really need to be doing is looking for the top 20 diagnoses that aren't being documented and looking for ways to help support that documentation in the medical record. So that's just a thought as well, because it sounds like there's already some, you know, documentation there in regards to these diagnoses.
I think the other thing to think about here with templates is, are these templates able to be individualized for that particular chart so that you could better specify the clinical indicators that would support the query in the first place? So are we talking a template that's just very generic, asking a general question? And then also including in that template that the physician has the opportunity to disagree or identify a different diagnosis that might be more appropriate than just stating a yes-no to that template. So there's a lot of factors that go into what are you really talking about when you say the word template, because they can be done in a variety of ways.
And there are a lot of different models with the electronic health records with ways to communicate with the physician, some of which are part of the electronic health record and some of which are kept separate from the formal electronic health record. There are some hospitals are using emails to the physicians. And with the emails, you can fashion some general templates, draw up your heart failure template, but put in the specific clinical information about the patient that says that the patient came in with worsening shortness of breath and the BNP level was somewhere around 3,500, whereas 2 weeks ago it was 200. And we have evidence of an ejection fraction written of 15% as evidence to lead the doctor to think further about it and then use your template for him to be able to respond in the medical record so that all you have is the email, which may or may not be retained depending on how you set your policies.
Okay. All right, I am showing someone with a question or a comment about this issue, so if Christine, can you please put through Robin for us, please?
Go ahead, caller, your line is live.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, this is Robin Keeney. I just wanted to add on to the comment that Dr. Gold just made related to templates, the question that was just issued. There is the capability under development out there where certain relational edits can be built on certain key diagnoses or conditions documented in the record. And then using the relational edits connected to the clinical indicators would generate a physician alert for a query. Obviously, those would have to be pretty locked tight with making sure that the clinical indicators supported what that electronic query was looking for. But I just wanted to put that out there to let you know that technology is available and is being developed in a lot of EMRs.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks, Robin. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
We do have another person waiting to get into the queue there, Jennifer. Christine, could you put Jennifer through for us, please?
Go ahead, caller. Your line is live.
Hi, this is Jennifer Remnick from Mercy Medical Center. I have a coding question. A patient came in with abdominal pain and underwent an open laparotomy, and the findings were necrosis of the omentum. They did an omentectomy, and the specimen that was sent to the pathology was the omentum. So according to the coding book, it was coded to 557.0, which is vascular insufficiency of the intestine. We are getting a denial based on that code that the operative report on the intestinal specimen was not sent to pathology. So they're looking for an intestines rather than the omentum. So I need some guidance on that. Can anyone comment on that?
I just took a look up for omental infarction, and it goes exactly as you say to 557.0. And so I think that your insurance company is going to have to go to the index and find out what the rules are so that they would know that you submitted the right code and you don't need a piece of intestine to show it.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Gold.
Very good. I did the same thing, got the same code.
Yay!
Yeah. Great. Thanks, guys.
All right, why don't we work? We did receive, again, several questions. I'll get through a few of them more. This next one, I'll be honest, was a little controversial even within our board. We did have a pre-call about some of these questions and discussed this one. I know there are thoughts on both sides of the issue. I thought maybe we could talk through it, but essentially, the question reads, I work in a community hospital where I'm the only CDI presence. We have issues where the patient is made into comfort measure only. We may or may not use the services to treat the impending death, i.e. oxygen at a high percentage delivery. Is it appropriate to identify the systems that are failing as a result of the dying process? And then she writes, realistically, the risk of mortality should be reflected by the documentation. I'll open that up to the board. You know, we had discussed this, and, you know, I guess there are different sides. I mean, the risk of mortality, I guess, should be high in a case of a dying patient, but, you know, how do you capture these if it's part of the dying process, and should you be capturing this stuff separately?
If nobody would object, I'd like to let you in on some extensive research I've done into this, that in fact the diseases that a patient has that leads to the patient then succumbing whether it's because the patient's in with sepsis and septic shock and acute renal failure and acute respiratory failure and metabolic encephalopathy and acute liver necrosis and DIC, and then everybody says we're going to withdraw life support and let the patient die. The processes that the body goes through in the active process of dying is not codable according to the UHDDS, according to the National Centers for Health Statistics, according to CMS, and according to Coding Clinic. So I wouldn't do it. The respiratory arrest that the patient has, the stoppage of putting out of urine that the patient has, the fact that he becomes unconscious, which you might call encephalopathy, that's part of the active dying process, and it's not codable. Those things that he had that led to the fact that he was going to die are all codable.
Okay. Now, the argument I've heard on the other side is that this is a patient that passes away in the hospital, and they should have a risk of mortality at that 4 or the high level.
Oh yeah. I mean, but the thing is, sometimes you don't know. If a patient comes in a cardiac arrest and dies in the emergency room, all you have is there's a cardiac arrest, and you may not have anything without an autopsy. So you're not going to have very much in the way of risk of mortality, because the only thing you can code is a cardiac arrest. On the other hand, as I say, if the patient has cancer with metastases to the brain and to the liver and hepatic encephalopathy and ascites and all these things, and while in the hospital or transferred to the hospice unit or whatever, they withdraw all life support and then he dies, all those diagnoses that led up to the fact that he was about to be allowed to die are codable. But the process of dying isn't.
So, Dr. Gold, this is Cheryl. Maybe it would be helpful if you do you have any guidelines or when the process of dying, when you can identify the process of dying has started? Because I think that it sounds like you're making a key distinction as to once the process of dying begins, that's not codable. So how would a CDI specialist know that they are dealing with a process of dying rather than something leading up to the process of dying?
The major thing that is identified in all of these documents is the cardiorespiratory arrest. Okay. When a patient who is in the process of dying has his heart stop, you know, somebody, the nurse calls the doctor over to pronounce the patient, and the patient is found to be dead. You don't code that cardiorespiratory arrest. If the patient is in the hospital for a hernia operation and has an arrest, you code it, whether the patient lives or dies. And Coding Clinic has a little bit of a discrepancy with that. If this is an unexpected event and the patient had a cardiorespiratory arrest and you're calling a code for that, that's a codable event. But while the patient is sitting in bed waiting for the patient to die and he dies, you don't code the body systems that stopped in the dying. You code all the diseases that he has, all the trauma that he has, everything in the world that he has, up until the point, you know, 5 minutes from now, he was alive. Now he's not alive. His heart stopped. If you're not going to do anything about it, he's dead. And that's described with discharge status 20. Discharge status 20 includes all the organs that shut down with death.
Yeah, I think this is great information you provided, Dr. Gold. I would feel remiss if I just didn't mention, Dr. Kennedy had a different opinion. He's not on the call today. I was hoping he would be, but I'll just read what he wrote, and I think he's done the right thing in that he elevated it to somewhat within a HEMA and is hoping to get, a really definitive statement somewhere in Coding Clinic. But he wrote, right or wrong, the states and the federal government are profiling hospitals according to their observed to expected inpatient mortality. So doing the not excluding cases that are identified to be palliative care or with that V66.7 code, do not resuscitate V49.86, and once admitted as an inpatient, these patients' condition deteriorates, yet the APR mortality score is relatively low, i.e. 1 or a 2, because the mechanisms of their death are present and documented but not acted upon.
Oh, I'm thinking that he's got a different idea there.
Okay.
When you're looking at mortality statistics from hospitals, and it depends on who's doing the computations of the mortality statistics, some places will exclude cases of patients where a V66.7 is assigned. They're going to take that patient out of the mix so that the diseases that the patient has had doesn't go into the overall hospital's mortality scores. This is not saying that you don't code those diseases. You do code the diseases, but that case gets taken out of the statistics. That's what he's talking about.
This is Cheryl. I would just like to clarify, though, that that practice of excluding palliative care cases is becoming less and less frequent.
Yeah.
Because what most of the data is showing is that your palliative care patients actually survive longer and do better. So I think sometimes it's confusing to CDI specialists and physicians that just because a patient is coded with palliative care doesn't mean that they will be excluded. It's becoming very limited when they are excluded for mortality purposes. And just to reiterate, palliative care itself does not have an SOI ROM score, nor is it a CC or an MCC. So the hospital doesn't necessarily get any credit for the fact that that patient is receiving palliative care. Also, to clarify further, CMS has shown us with their metrics that they are now differentiating between palliative care and comfort measures, because the term palliative care has become, if you will, overused in the hospital setting. And they really want to define those patients who are just on comfort measures and are truly at end of life, because other people can have palliative care services that aren't necessarily at end of life. So there needs to be that differentiation in terms of abstracting data for core measures, even though the code is one and the same. So it's important to realize that this is getting to be a very kind of muddy topic, if you will, because a lot of physicians were educated that by adding palliative care, it will exclude the population, and that's becoming less frequent. The other thing that I would encourage, though, is that there's a big difference between a patient who is admitted in a serious condition and then decides to seek palliative care or hospice care versus a patient who comes into the hospital while on palliative care and hospice care, because oftentimes you can have a medical necessity issue for those patients that have already had that designation prior to entering the hospital rather than one who receives that designation during a hospital stay.
I think that's very important stuff that you brought up, and in fact, I'm sure that the guys have been saying that the V66.7 should not be assigned when a patient gets a palliative care consult, so that the palliative care consult can provide for the patient's survival for the next 40 years, but only when it's only comfort measures that you're going to provide, and that's it. You're absolutely right.
I think that was some great information. We've been seeing that as well with some of our carriers, that they're not excluding them anymore. The other thing I'd point out is that our palliative care service has exploded, and they do a wonderful job, and more of those patients are going home to go home with hospice and things like that. So they are actually leaving the hospital alive, which is something that CMS and all the rest of the payers are very interested in.
Well, thanks, Cheryl. Maybe we can get some of that guidance out and some sort of documentation for our members. It is important stuff. We do have a question from or comment from Paul, who might be weighing in on this issue. Can we put through Paul, Christine?
Go ahead, caller. Your line is live.
Hi, this is Paul. I want to first say I do agree with the thought expressed by Dr. Gold that you really never code cardiac arrest when the patient expires. This is a natural process, and it's not separately codable. We have a very large palliative care population in San Francisco, and the codes, patients with a V66.7 are not excluded from our risk of mortality, and I think one of the twists on this, the way I explain it and use it, and it may be controversial, we have patients that are maybe 50 years old and they're admitted with a stroke, and you'd expect that they would survive, but in some patients the stroke is so significant that they have a large hernia of the brain, but the physicians might call this a significant midline shift, you know, with absent neurological reflexes and so forth. And because of the fact the patient has had the midline shift, they are made palliative care. But in those situations, we ask the physician, is this a hernia of the brain? Because even though the patient is expected to expire and they're put on palliative care, the hernia of the brain, in my thought process, explains the medical decision-making the physician goes through and explains why the patient was placed on palliative care and why they died, and that is a big factor in their ROM. So sometimes our docs they'll just say the patient has a stroke and midline shift, and they make them DNR. They don't intervene, and their thought process is, well, if I didn't do anything about the hernia of the brain, it can't be coded, and I don't agree with that. I think the hernia of the brain explains clinically why these patients do expire and why they do have expected different outcomes than other patients.
Oh, great input, Paul. We appreciate it. Any comments from the board on that? Okay. As I mentioned at the outset of the call, we are offering a CEU with this call, so I'm going to ask our listeners to feel like a huckster or something, selling some product. But please, if you would, grab a pen and get ready to write this important note. Again, your participation in today's call is worth one CEU towards our CCDS certification. It's pretty very easy to do. Just if you could follow these instructions. The main thing is we'd like you to send an email to the following address. So again, if you have a pen handy, it's CEU@CDIAssociation.com. Again, CEU@CDIAssociation.com. We ask that you put the following code into the subject line. So the code you need to enter is 111512. Penny has asked that you put your name, title, and facility in the body of the email. So again, email to CEU@CDIAssociation.com. Put 111512 in the subject line, and then include your name, title, and facility in the body of the email. I'll read those again at the end. And again, as you know, all these calls are posted on the quarterly calls page, so you can listen to these again. But you can certainly email Penny if you have any questions about it. She did reiterate that if you're listening with a group at your facility, one person can request a certificate on behalf of the group, and to please allow 30 days to receive that certificate. So we are pleased to be able to offer a CEU for these calls. Okay, not seeing any other questions in the queue at this time, so I will move to our next question. This is a very lengthy question, so I'm paraphrasing it, but it's an important issue, sort of about complications of care and complications of surgery and so forth. But basically, it reads: I started a new CDI job at a medical center that is known as a center of excellence for bariatric surgery. Facility does over 50% of the gastric bypasses in our state. I'm running into a roadblock because I'm getting the feeling they're uncomfortable with using the new bariatric complication codes because they feel it will be reported to the health grades and other profiling agencies and affect their center of excellence rating. Of course, the documentation never says that a post-anastomotic ulcer is related or a complication of the surgery. They feel this is a negative mark against them. Can't find any coding guidance and would like your opinion. She does give a long example here, but basically she wants to know whether if anyone would know how to find out if these new bariatric codes would negatively affect their center of excellence rating. Would appreciate any and all comments. Open up discussion on the call. So I'll open this up to the board. I know that this is an important issue with accuracy of the documentation and what occurred should be what's reported versus the pressure of the physicians that don't want this stuff reported. Again, and any comments or advice from our board on this particular issue?
There's only one little piece that I might mention, and that is when you're not going to get a post-anastomotic ulcer for several weeks to months after the procedure. It's going to be a different hospital stay. And any 900 series code or complication code that appears in a principal diagnosis position is not assigned and not considered under the AHRQ or any other patient safety guidelines.
Yeah, I mean, I think the example, actually, she mentioned the patient came back after 5 weeks with a GI bleed. EGD is performed, found to have a post-anastomotic bleeding ulcer.
Yeah. Right now, the way the algorithms are written, if it's a principal diagnosis or present on admission, it does not count.
This is Cheryl. I completely agree with Dr. Gold is saying, and I would just expand it one step further. I think a lot of times what's missing is you need to find out what the specific concern is of the physician. It sounds like this one is center of excellence, but a lot of times physicians don't understand that a lot of the quality measures are abstracted data rather than coded data. And so coding says that, you know, you can't document something unless the physician makes the relationship. But with abstracted data, if all the pieces are there according to the data index, then something can be picked up as a complication even if the physician does not set it as such. So physicians need to be very aware of that. And also, as Dr. Gold was referring to AHRQ, for their patient safety indicators or different things like that, they identify the specific codes that are used in order to pick up that particular type of complication. And so if this doesn't map to one of those types of code, then no complication would be reported, if you will. However, it's still also important to look at whether internally these types of things could be seen for credentialing purposes. So there's several different levels that you would have to look at to see whether or not there really would be an impact. But I think one of the basic things we can do as CDI specialists is make sure that our physicians are educated that just because it's considered a complication code in coding purposes doesn't mean that the physician did something wrong.
I think this also raises a problem that coders are facing these days, and that becomes whether or not you actually code that complication even if the physician didn't call it a complication. Coding clinic clearly says that if the physician doesn't call it a complication, you're not supposed to code it. But there's the ethical side of that. We all know the ulcer in this case was a result of the bariatric surgery. There isn't anything else to explain it. So what do you do? Do you let it go, or do you do the right thing and code it? I think that's a question that's going to have to be addressed in the near future.
Yep. Yeah, I guess I'll take a minute just to interject that we are working on a Actis and a HEMA are working on a practice brief in collaboration that does address these types of issues where, you know, stuff that's not reported, or, you know, we all know that you have to report what's there, but what if it's not clinically supported in the record? Also, these types of ethical issues and how to kind of elevate that to an appropriate entity within your organization, whether it's a physician advisor or a chief ethical officer, because this, you know, these are real issues. And, you know, and it, actually this question goes on to state that, you know, the coding book specifically states reported out as two codes, the bleeding post anastomotic GJ ulcer gives an MCC, but they're willing to take the loss so as not to be reported out as a complication. So, yeah, there you have it. We know that this is happening, and you know, it's a difficult issue. There's no doubt about it. But I think, you know, having that information out there and being able to show physicians exactly how it does impact their score or does not, depending on, you know, the particular board, depending on the particular website that you're, you know, health grades versus the Center of Excellence ratings and others, they have different formulas. We think, you know, that's probably a good place to start in terms of, you know, making sure you're presenting the physicians with the most accurate information. Have you had these types of conversations, I guess, maybe Dr. LaCharite or others with your, you know, with your doctors?
We had that conversation today, actually. We received a denial from a payer because we coded an obvious accidental intestinal laceration that needed to be repaired and obviously caused the patient to be on the table longer and things like that, and the physician never specifically called it a complication, so they don't want to pay the increased DRG that it resulted in. And our argument is, how could you not code that when it caused subsequent care changes? But, you know, again, the same issue was raised. Should we have coded it? Should we have not coded it? And what are the ethics of it? We know what coding clinic says, but, you know, that patient goes out of here with a complication that we caused, somebody should know about it.
Yep. Yep.
And, Brian, if I could just add one more thought to this. Even though the physician may not give you that linkage, I think it's important to note that the queries, the organization should be querying, and then at least it's on the physician that refused to make that linkage in the documentation, because organizations are being held for what they are and are not querying for. So it's important that they recognize that that relationship is there and needs to be established, and then it's up to the physician to add the documentation, but at least they're asking that question and they've recognized that issue.
This is Donna, and another piece to add to what Cheryl's saying, the query is extremely important. And one of the opportunities that I think a lot of people are missing is the fact that you can actually add a POA assignment next to that code of a W of clinically undetermined if you have queried that physician and he's not quite sure when or when that actual complication occurred or how it occurred or if it was a result of the surgery or if the patient came in with the impending condition. We've run statistics, actually, at AHIMA, the national meeting, they ran statistics for us of how often the W is used, and it was a very small percentage. So just think about that. You can use that as a POA indicator if you query the physician.
Yeah, I see, Donna, you just forwarded me a resource from HealthGrades, updated for 2012, maps out all the procedures and diagnoses that may affect quality scores. So information is available. It's just a matter of tracking it down and make sure your physicians are aware of it. You know, not all of these count against them. Some of them do. I appreciate that. Maybe I can get that posted after the call.
Okay, good.
I am showing another question from Sharrington. Is it Sharrington or Charlie Morrell?
Yes. Brian, this has to do with the health grades that we're talking about, and the palliative care diagnosis. When health grades came to our facility, they were telling people in the coding that they should try to get that diagnosis of palliative care in the first 9 codes because that influenced the quality ratings. So I just wondered if anybody had heard that as well and could speak to that.
This is Cheryl, and I know Donna's probably very knowledgeable about this too. It used to be that with the UB40, which is how we build electronically, we were only able to submit those 10 codes, and so it had to be in those top 10 codes in order to be captured. And a lot of groupers did not sequence that palliative code very high because it was considered kind of irrelevant because it didn't add a CC, MCC, it didn't have a big impact on the DRG assignment. But with the switch to the UB50, which is the new electronic billing format that we need for ICD-10, we're now submitting 25 diagnoses. So now it only needs to appear in the top 25 diagnoses as of January 1st, 2012, and so it's not going to be as much of an issue as it was for organizations previously to that.
Does that help answer your question, Charlie? Or?
Yes, actually, that's awesome. That's great information.
Okay.
Yeah. And there's actually 18 on the paper UB. Yeah, thank you.
What was that, Don? You said 18?
There's 18 diagnoses secondary on the paper format of the UB04.
Okay. All right. I am showing another question. I think it's, is it Maureen or is it Maureen?
Yes, it's Maureen.
Oh, hello. You can proceed with your question.
Thank you. Thank you to everyone. My question is a particular situation that we keep facing. Patient is admitted with multiple diagnoses, including acute on chronic respiratory failure, acute cor pulmonale and an acute exacerbation of their pulmonary fibrosis. And we're in a discussion about the sequencing of these multiple diagnoses present on admission with our coding department and have been researching this on coding clinics. So I would be interested in anyone's opinion on the multiple diagnoses with these three in particular.
It's a shame Dr. Hike, who's a pulmonologist, isn't here, because though you can have a patient who has pulmonary fibrosis getting worse, it takes time for the patients to get worse, and pulmonary fibrosis does not acutely decompensate itself. Something else can happen in a patient with pulmonary fibrosis that can cause the chronic respiratory failure from the pulmonary fibrosis to get worse. A patient who has chronic cor pulmonale due to the pulmonary fibrosis, which is what's leading to or the measure of the patient's chronic respiratory failure, that's another thing that is a chronic condition which itself doesn't change. It's just that something else is going on in the background. The patient acute on chronic respiratory failure has gotten worse. There, when you're talking about somebody who has cor pulmonale, basically the only things that can cause acute cor pulmonale are pulmonary embolism and rupture of a tricuspid valve. And your patient didn't have that. I think the doctor's overdoing the word acute in certain decompensated conditions, which it's not really acute. It's just getting worse. You got acute respiratory failure.
What's the difference between getting worse and acute, I guess?
Yeah.
The acute, you know, we often do go after the acute cor pulmonale when patients come in with some obvious edema, breathing problems, and then they're treated with, you know, BiPAP along with IV Lasix, and the edema recedes along with their breathing.
And if you take into account that left heart failure, whatever the cause of the left heart failure, be it ischemic cardiomyopathy or hypertensive cardiomyopathy or whatever. Now, I won't say hypertensive because there's a dumb rule with hypertensive. Ischemic or alcoholic or amyloid or any of those other things. When the patient comes in with CHF due to the left heart failure, the CHF has to go first. When your patient comes in with right heart failure and the cor pulmonale, the CHF has to go first again. And you should not be sequencing acute cor pulmonale first, because you don't do anything to treat acute cor pulmonale. You treat the thing that's causing the acute cor pulmonale.
So, Dr. Gold, are you saying then that you would sequence the acute on chronic respiratory failure as the primary diagnosis?
In that case of yours, yes.
Okay. Okie doke. Anyone else have any other opinions on that?
I would agree with Dr. Gold.
Okay. Thank you very much.
We'll just give the usual. Sometimes it's hard with these specific coding scenarios without seeing the medical record and so forth to give a definitive answer, but these are just kind of our best opinions based on the facts that were given, so I hope that helped you out. I do want to get to one other question that we had pre-submitted. It's regarding simple versus complex pneumonia and how CDI teams handle this case. You know, so they said they're having an issue with our physicians concerning the use of pneumonia unspecified. Most of their charts are coding to 193 to 195 simple pneumonia DRG. Their physicians use the terms community acquired and hospital acquired to describe whether a pneumonia is simple versus complex. We've been asking if they can at least use possible probable suspect and identify what organism they think they're treating. We're being met with statements like, well, we don't do respiratory cultures here because 50% of the time they're coming up negative, even though we know there's an organism. And even when we do bronchoscopies, we don't always isolate the bug until the patient has been discharged and the discharge summary has already been written. Another statement has been, you're trying to get us to lie and say we know that we're treating, so the hospital makes more money. Do you have any advice on how to handle these types of things?
I'm going to say listen to your doctors, and then I'll shut up and let everyone
Any other comments from the, Cheryl, is there anything you used to run into with your old facility or ran? I don't know if you've seen anything like this happen and what advice you might have.
This is Cheryl. I think one of the things that I've been teaching in a lot of my boot camps is that, you know, if you read the literature, and certainly I'm a nursing by background, I'm not a physician, so I don't presume to, you know, be able to diagnose pneumonia. But if you do a lot of reading and research, there's a lot of talk about how you identify HCAP and HCCAP, which is healthcare-acquired pneumonia or hospital-acquired pneumonia or healthcare-associated pneumonia. Those are all different acronyms that are represented by HAC and HCAP. And so a lot of times this is based on the epidemiology of the patient's presentation. For example, they received dialysis, they've been in an ICU for 2 days in the past 90 days, different types of criteria like that. And I think one of the things that we should do as CDI specialists is encourage our physicians to make their diagnosis based on the evidence presented before them. And so I think it would be appropriate to advise the physician to say something like, there is evidence of this particular type of infection, and just because it wasn't grown out into a sputum or a culture doesn't negate that you are treating based on your expertise, your, you know, the patient's presentation and so forth regarding this condition, because something is driving the treatment plan. So we just want to capture what the physician is using to guide that treatment plan in documentation to see whether or not we have a simple pneumonia or we have a more complex pneumonia.
One of the things you do look at is the core measures for pneumonia, where one of the elements is appropriate choice of antibiotics. And as Cheryl said, you do have to use the risk factors in order to be able to make such determinations. They do say that if you can first identify that the patient's at risk of Pseudomonas pneumonia and you're going to treat the patient with amikacin or tobramycin, which is specific for Pseudomonas pneumonia, then it looks like you're treating Pseudomonas pneumonia because that's what you believe it is in a bronchiectasis patient or in a patient with cystic fibrosis whose last five pneumonias have been due to Pseudomonas. However, if a culture comes back and shows that it was MRSA, then you say what I originally thought was Pseudomonas turned out to be MRSA. The second thing is to be able to identify aspiration pneumonia according to the core measures, and you look at the patient's risk factors regarding the likelihood that this is either related to swallowing dysfunction or related to debilitating gastroesophageal reflux, which is the other 50% of the aspiration pneumonias, which occur at night. And the antibiotic coverage for aspiration pneumonia is specific at most hospitals and different than the Rocephin and Zithromax that everybody has coming through the door. When a patient has had many episodes of MRSA pneumonia before and comes in with a similar kind of picture, the doc will presume that that's what it is until he gets evidence that it wasn't by culture results or the patient doesn't respond to the antibiotics for that MRSA pneumonia. And the last area that the docs can speak sort of authoritatively is if there's a blood culture that was positive, that he feels, because that's one of the things that's done in the emergency room even more effectively than sputum cultures. If the blood culture he feels is related to that pneumonia, please make that link. Or if a particular organism is identified by any sort of lab results like Legionella or some of the other organisms that you can get antibodies to be able to identify that this is the organism at risk that is likely your source, then go for it. But when you see the patients on Rocephin and Zithromax coming through the door, I wouldn't ask a doctor to make any guesses whatsoever because he doesn't know.
Mm-hmm. No, that's great advice. You know, it is a those medications, I guess, issued, and knowing when to ask and timing it, you know, later in the stay when there might be more clarity around it. But another great question. I am showing we do have a Katie on the line with a question. Maybe we'll get to this, and then we'll wrap things up. Katie, did you want to ask a question, please?
Yes. We've been talking in our CDI group about coding failed mesh graft as a complication code. It's 996.59, and the discussion has involved whether there needs to explicitly be documented that the graft itself was the cause of the complication, or whether the graft was no longer functioning in its intended purpose, you know, whether it was due to the anatomy of the patient or body habitus or what have you. We're just trying to determine. We were given instruction through our program to clarify for whether a recurrent hernia was due to a failed mesh graft in a case where patients have existing grafts. But now we're kind of in discussion with the coders about when it would be appropriate to use that code.
Any experience with the board with that particular code? Or?
I'm thinking that this code was specifically developed because of the issues that occur with implantable things in pelvic and bladder and all kinds of other pelvic organ support structures where there's erosion of the device through the tissue, not necessarily infection, but it's an erosion through the tissue, rather than a hernia that occurs nearby it, because you can't necessarily say that it's a mechanical and I think that you're probably going to be right to ask the question. You can't necessarily say that it's a mechanical complication of the graft's material if the patient's own tissue nearby broke down. However, making that call, I think it's not a bad idea.
But then would you say using that code, even though the doctor may say that the graft was no longer functioning, but not because of the graft itself, because it does code to a complication code, I guess we're just trying to determine whether it would be appropriate to use the code unless it was the graft itself that had failed to work.
Well, if you look at all the coding clinic references that refer to that code, all of them have to do with erosion of the implanted stuff through the skin or through the tissue.
Okay, because in the few examples we've had lately, it's been where the graft detaches from the abdominal wall, or it's, you know, the procedure note describes the graft as being bunched up, you know, where it's obviously not where it should be.
As a surgeon who's put some stuff in, that's bad technique. That's not the graft.
I suppose you might have that link explicit then, I would think. You would have to.
That's another complication of surgery, no question about it, but not necessarily because of the graft material.
Sure.
And again, as principal diagnosis, it's not going to give a ding to your hospital or to the physician,
right?
Because the data doesn't know who put it in.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Well, we're a few minutes past the top of the hour. I'm just going to one last time reiterate how to get your CEU for participating on today's call. Again, if you don't have a pen handy, please send an email to ceu@cdiassociation.com. Put the following code into the subject line, 111-512. your name, title, and facility in the body of the email. And again, we'll send you out a certificate with your CEU for listening to this call. If you have any questions about it, you know, Penny Richards is the person to reach. Her name is right on our certification pages, and she'd be happy to handle that for you. Again, this does wrap up our quarterly conference call at this time. We do post these calls on our quarterly calls page, so you can go back and listen to them if you had to hang up early or you dialed in late and you missed some of it. It's certainly there as a reference. And we hope you enjoyed the call, and we will talk to you soon. Have a good rest of the day, everybody.